Yeah, I think there are two kinds of capitalism. There is creative capitalism and there is parasitic capitalism.
That's right.
And unfortunately, it's the second variety that predominates. If you study Islamic history, because for 1,000 years the Muslims controlled the trade of the world through their monopoly of the Silk Road, which they inherited from the Roman Empire, and the only way that the West could traffic with the East was by courtesy of Islam. Now, pepper by the sea route, after the Portuguese had shown how the Muslim control of global trade could be circumvented through their voyages of discovery and their superiority in naval architecture, pepper, which was very important in the cuisine of Europe, in the hold of an East Indiaman, cost one-fifth of what it cost by the overland route, that is to say along the Silk Road, because at each stage there would be those custom houses. I've seen two of them. I've seen one of them in Afghanistan still surviving and another one in Isfahan in Iran, both marking stopping points on the Silk Road, both at river crossings. At each point, the Muslim government in charge, Iranian, Ottoman, Iraqi or whatever, would levy dues on the goods in the caravans. Now, according to traditional Islamic teaching, the function of Muslim ruler is twofold. It is to generate wealth through trade, which we could call real capitalism. And the second is to express this wealth thereby generated in a religiously accepted way, that is to say, through the foundation of madrasas, mosques, and charitable foundations.
Well, but you have to also understand that as the East India Company got underway with Jewish financing and Jewish money, they also saw other opportunities of exploitation, and they used their... One of the things that we know throughout the 18th century was that weaponry, because of continued fighting between nations, weapons in the West, in Europe, and in America, were constantly being reinvented so they could learn new ways of killing each other. Mm-hmm. And once these weapons were brought to a point of being a mass murder weapons, they were turned on populations such as China. They were turned mm-hmm. on populations such as Japan.
That's
they were
right.
turned on people in Indonesia, and what they did instead was they forced these people to build plantations in their control, buy opium from Sassoon, force the Japanese into coming from a feudal society into a new one. But they never; these countries didn't have a choice. They were forced into these changes at the point of a gun and murdered into submission. And you see, then they used it. Of course, then their morals come in. Their lack of morality comes in by turning China into an addicted nation of opium addicts. Or the subjugation and the criminal activity of this gang out of London, where they held sway, and out of New York, where they held sway, is legendary. And it's so easy to prove. And when we learn this in our history books in America, when I was young. It never once said these people were Zionist Jews or that they were from the Jewish community. Never.
Mm.
And you brought something up in our private call today.
Mm.
This guy,
can I read you from a different history book, Jakub Zaki's History of Islam in Britain, called The Shadow of the Crescent. Now, here I've talked about the Sassoons. The Sassoons came from Bombay, but seem to have originated in Spain. Fleeing religious persecution, like other Sephardim, they sought refuge in the Muslim world, ending up in Baghdad. The family rose to eminence through the opium trade when they moved from Bombay from Iraq in 1825 and cashed in on the free trade bonanza. Free trade is very important, you know, which followed the abolition of the East India Company's monopoly in 1834. David Sassoon's Sons and Co. was founded by a son of the merchant banker, Sheikh Sassoon ibn Saleh. They all had Arab names, right down to Abdullah Sassoon, who moved to Britain, was absorbed into the British aristocracy, and was one of the financial backers of Queen Victoria's son. Anyway, to get back to this, Sheikh Sassoon was a court Jew, grown rich on the interest and loans made to the Ottoman government He was treasurer to Ahmed Pasha, the governor of Baghdad. David was born in Baghdad in 1792, but following a corruption scandal, he fled to India. Setting up in Bombay, the Sassoons entered the lucrative opium trade, exporting the drug to India. This was the inferior Malwa product, which varied in quality, unlike the company-supervised opium production at Patna and Ghazipur. How entire districts of the native states passed under opium cultivation makes fascinating history. By the 1830s, Malwa posed a serious threat to the Gangetic Basin, which the East India Company were busy converting into one vast poppy garden. To begin with, the Sassoons lent penurious cultivators money to buy cottonseed. When the cultivators couldn't sell enough cotton to meet the interest on the loan, the Sassoons offered an alternative. Instead of cotton, they would loan money for poppy seed, manure, and irrigation for the thirsty poppies, even money to pay for the swarms of migrant field workers needed to milk the pods. In doing so, they were but following time-honored precedent. The Hindu Banya caste had always advanced money to the peasants so that they could purchase draft animals as well as seed, manure, and even living costs, pending the harvest of the opium crop. Subject to the law of Manu, whereby debt is hereditary, the cultivators were head over heels in debt to the Banyas, who had them in their toils, and so could not quarrel over the price paid for the annual crop. Soon Malwa was making up in quantity for what it lacked in quality, compared with company opium. So long as Jardines and Dent monopolized the opium trade with their clippers, delivering to receiving ships up and down the China coast, the Sassoons found it difficult to break into the market. After the traffic in opium was legalized in 1858, all this was to change. Using steamers to deliver the drug directly to land-based retailers and benefiting from their proximity to the sources of production, even advancing producers up to three-quarters of their costs, they undercut the profit of Jardine Matheson to such extent that by 1871, they controlled 70% of the trade. Unable to cope, Jardines gave up dealing in opium the following year and chose to diversify. Their other rival, Dent & Co., had already founded in 1867 in consequence of the financial crisis of 1865-66, leaving the Sassoons the undisputed masters of the opium trade. Now, I want to go on further to this, because there's something very interesting.
Well, I'd like to bring one thing up before you do, James, that the Sassoons intermarried with the Rothschilds. And,
They were known as the Rothschilds of the East. At a certain point, the Rothschilds of the East fused with the Rothschilds of the West.
Well, that's right. And then, interesting, the group that they were selling opium to in North America, which they tried to get that market started, but it never took off as well for them, was the family called Delano. And if you remember Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his family name is Delano. They were big opium dealers with Sassoon and Rothschild, and so the roots of the Roosevelt dynasty, if you'd like, the Bush dynasty, was built on cocaine. Roosevelt, which is a Jewish origin, came from drug dealing.
Roosevelt is really Rosenfeld, and they were Dutch Jews who arrived in New York State from Holland in the 17th century.
Yeah.
Although nominally Christian, they were in fact Jewish. And the interesting thing is that Frank FDR never once referred to the source of the family fortune that enabled him to become President of the United States for four successive terms. And
Delano.
All the money came from the Delanos, who were opium smugglers.
That's right. That's exactly right. You're right on the money with this stuff. So go ahead and continue, because this is important, because this money is what was sloshing around, being used to foment wars, to finance manufacture of weaponry, to topple governments, to start massacres in Armenia. And you know, the Armenian people were very, very well educated before this massacre took place. They were actual rivals in the Caucasus region as administrators, because they had a very strong history of being well educated, and it was the oldest Christian community in the world.
It was, Armenia was the first state in the world to become Christian. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So, there were a lot of reasons why they started targeting different groups around the world, and, mm-hmm. and they used the money from drug dealing. Now, guess what? The parallel to today is that opium dealing and cocaine sales are still being used by the same group to destroy our planet and create political intrigue and murder and mayhem globally, and it's the same people behind it, and it's just a different generation.
Well, it's no longer opium. It's heroin, which is a derivative of opium,
right.
And cocaine, which are far worse. Because, you see, the Christian missionaries, who are a bunch of idiots, in my opinion, they banned the opium trade altogether. They were so stupid, they didn't realize that history shows that every time a drug is banned, that drug is replaced by something stronger. And addiction spreads. And this lays the basis for those crime syndicates who are making fortunes out of it. But of that, to that we can come later. I go back to my book. In 1872, the year in which the Sassoons came into possession of three-quarters of India's opium crop, marginalizing both Jardines and Alfred Dent & Co., the successors to Dent & Co., Abdullah pulled off another coup, getting himself knighted by Queen Victoria. With stunning sycophancy, who had changed his name from Abdullah to Albert, so was now Sir Albert Sassoon, 1st Baronet of Kensington Gore. His son, Sir Edward, married Aline Caroline de Rothschild, so the Rothschilds of the East now fused with the Rothschilds of the West. The family's most famous son, Siegfried Sassoon, who died in 1967, one of the patriarch's 14 grandsons, died a Catholic. Now, the Sassoons had set up in a big way in Shanghai following the first opium war, as a result of which Shanghai became one of the five treaty ports. The missionaries made opium the scapegoat for their lack of success in converting China to Christianity. And when their evangelizing efforts met with only modest success, they blamed the British government. Hordes of rice Christians swarming round the mission compounds hardly made up for the absence of a single well-educated Mandarin. Pressure from the British authorities and public opinion, especially in America, where Protestant missionary influence was strong, led to the International Opium Conference in Shanghai in 1909, called by President Roosevelt, the first President Roosevelt, Teddy, at the behest of Bishop Brent. The real motive for the conference was to placate the missionary lobby, as also the mercantile class, who thought that Chinese silver used to buy British opium could be better spent on other and American products. So it goes on. But, I mean, for instance here, the scheme took the form of a monopoly called the Shanghai Opium Merchants Combine, founded in 1913 and controlled by a committee comprising all the big names, both Jewish and Hindu. Listen to this. D.E.J. Abraham, Simon A. Levy, Evelyn David, E. Nassim, R.D. Catania, B.D. Tata, that's a Hindu name, B.C. Setna, Sagal Favre, B.H. Dastur, F. Dowji, F. Chandra Boyand, and R. Bagoria. These latter ones may be Hindu, because you know they say the Hindus are the Jews of Asia. These gentry entered into an agreement with the Shanghai Opium Dealers Guild, whereby the guild would recognize the combine's monopoly and undertake not to buy from any other source. The Opium Dealers Guild was a front for the Swatow gangsters, who enjoyed exclusive control of the domestic market. With the combine importing it and the guild retailing it, opium in China flourished as never before. One year, when the Chinese government had no alternative but to buy up the combine's entire stock so they could destroy it, the Sassoons netted $14 million Chinese dollars. This was not the first time the Sassoons had brought off such a coup. They had earlier succeeded in marginalizing the wily Scots in 1856 during the Second Opium War, when Jardine prudently declined to bid in the Calcutta opium auction, foreseeing problems in delivering the drug under wartime conditions. Three Sassoon brothers, E. Goubet, Edward Ezra, and S. Isaac, bought up the entire Patna crop, let's say the company crop, transported by clipper steamers. It was warehoused in floating godowns up and down the China coast until there should be an opium famine, when famished addicts would be prepared to pay any price a retailer cared to ask. By now, the opium wholesalers were so deeply in debt to the Soons, they were left with no alternative but to deal exclusively with them. The opium wars were, in fact, the result of a balance of payments crisis. You see, the Chinese had got the wrong idea. The Chinese had a high culture, but they were surrounded to the north and to the west by barbarian tribes like the Mongols. So they thought the only way they can protect their political integrity and their cultural identity was by building the Great Wall. They had forgotten about the other wall that would have been necessary, the one on the coast. And that is how China eventually collapsed. It was invaded, not from the west, by barbarians getting through the Great Wall. It was invaded from the east through the sea routes controlled by the British Navy.
But we also see American traders involved in this, working with the British, and we also see Portuguese involved, Portuguese Jews in mm-hmm. Macau. We see these triad gangs, so the birth of the triad gangs out of opium dealing, and they still hold sway in China. Many of the political class came out of these opium gangster groups. And their control and their allegiance to Jewish money interests is still very strong today. A lot of people keep telling me that the Chinese are independent thinkers, they're independent, but when you take a look at where who butters their bread, you'll find out that Zionist Jewish money, again, is very much involved in China as it is everywhere else. Where do you think they got the money to build all these factories over the last 30 years? It came from Zionist Jewish banking money. And they built mm-hmm. them, and they're indebted to them. So mm-hmm. we see the same stuff over and over again, James.
Well,
one of the things
when I was teaching at Harvard, and I was just a sabbatical replacement there, I observed the crime scene in Boston. One of my colleagues, he bought a house in the heart of the Italian Quarter, because the Italian Quarter in Boston is controlled by the Mafia. Now, that is the one drug-free zone in the whole of Boston. And if you have a family, and you want to bring them up free of any contact with drugs, the safest place to live is the Italian Quarter. Because whilst the Mafia sell the drugs to others, they do not sell them to their own family. And MD attempting to do so, to sell Mafia, drugs to the children of a Mafia family, would be immediately liquidated, and there's no appeal against a sentence of death from the Mafia. You're just eliminated, that's that.
Yeah, now, but when you find out that the Mafia, James, the Mafia got its beginnings dealing with Zionist Jews above them.
Well, there were three mafias operating in Boston when I was teaching at Harvard. One was the Italian Mafia, second was the Jewish Mafia, and the third was the Chinese Mafia. But
the Irish Mafia in the South End, though, you can't forget about the Irish Mafia.
Well, again, that's another factor, because that's so closely related to politics, isn't it, and Kennedy?
Oh, boy. Yeah,
well,
it is.
But that's another subject. However, you mentioned Hollywood. I mean, Hollywood is the greater distorter of history after the court historians of the British establishment who control the universities, because films like The Godfather, they paint the wrong picture. The Jews were, in fact, in control of the mob in America during the 20s and the 30s.
That's
and you're
exactly
led to believe
right.
It was exclusively an Italian monopoly.
Now,
nothing
at the
of
top,
the
financiers were 100% Jewish, and you see that with the founding of Las Vegas. You see it with the Italians being controlled out of Chicago at the top by Zionist Jews. Same with Boston. Same with New York. And they just got a group to do their dirty work. And, you know, they did the same thing during the cocaine manifestation. The Jews were owning and controlling the flow of cocaine, but they got the Dominicans to do their dirty work on the streets, and they got their the Jamaicans to do it, and they got their mostly islanders out of the Caribbean were their new mafia. And but at the top, the Jews were providing them with their drugs and with their money laundering elements coming in out of the Jewish bank control out of Panama and out of Cartagena and, of course, Medellin and the rest. And it goes back to families like Kushner and others.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So we have, in fact, an organic link between A, finance, B, drugs, C, crime.
That's right. And they don't want these drugs. See, the best thing to do for drugs, James, is to not make them illegal and treat people with drug problems as a medical issue and treat people so that the drugs don't become a criminalized element, because that allows these people to hive off money and look for new victims.
Yeah.
If you make it a health issue, you have access to the people using the drugs in order to get them off of them, and you take away the profit motive out of the crime gangs, which they use to support their other interests.
But hold on. If you decriminalize drugs like hashish and cocaine, it just means that these same gangsters will shift their interest elsewhere, to gambling and prostitution.
Well, this is true. Again, see, but you can't legislate morality, because what's happened is as soon as you, if you're in a free society, people will find new ways of corrupting the next group. What you can do is educate people away from immoral acts. And this takes a great deal of determination in a society. But when you're being completely destroyed from within, and your entire culture is being taken over by a traumatic traumatic thought process, you'll never have a moral bent on your society. There will not be moral fortitude in order to come up against these things. See, the way to stop people from using drugs or prostitution is they have to say no to it themselves. And and if there's no market for the stuff, you can't sell it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, as soon as you make something illegal and you've already got an immoral society to start with, you've got fertile ground to expand. And that's exactly where we are today.
And you think this is the role of Hollywood? It's the degradation of morals.
Well, they play a major role in it, but of course, the pornography industry does, the prostitution industry, the white slavery industry, even the use of slavery as a tool in the founding of America through the Jewish interests in Newport, Rhode Island, through this guy Aaron Lopez and the rest.
Oh, they controlled the slave trade. There's no doubt about that.
The reason I'm getting to that is
they controlled the white slave trade. In fact, I wonder how many of our listeners know the name of Ahmed Shukairi. Does it resonate with you at all, Darryl?
No.
At one time he was famous, but nobody knows about him today. No, we're going back to the 60s, before the eclipse of Arab nationalism took place as a consequence of the Egyptian debacle in the June War of 1967. Until that 1967, the Palestinian cause was very tightly controlled by the Arab tyrannical regimes, principally Egypt, which was the most powerful. Now, Nasser had a Palestinian front, which was called the PLA. Most people think that means these initials stand for the People's Liberation Army. It doesn't. Well, it does. But it also stands for the Palestine Liberation Army, which didn't even liberate one inch of Palestine. But that was not its function. Its function was to control the whole Palestinian issue in the interests of the Nasserist tyranny. And Nasser's wife, was Baha'i. But this takes us into a different sphere altogether. Nasser was a CIA man.
Yes.
He was appointed by the CIA in order to get the British out of the Middle East, because there are two wars taking place. One is the war that we all know about, and the second is the invisible war between Britain and America, which is waged over control of markets and access to raw materials. And after 1918, the Middle East, the former Ottoman Empire, became Britain's back garden. However, NASA was installed in 1952 by the CIA as part of this program to get the British out of the Middle East so as to install them themselves. Now, it was he who made Ahmed Shoukry the head of the PLA. Now, a debate was taking place at the United Nations headquarters in New York. And the person who was on his feet speaking that day as head of the Israeli delegation was Abba Eban, real name Aubrey Evans, again South African connection, prominent South African Jew, who had taken Israeli nationality. And he was on his feet, he was giving it big licks. He said, the Arabs, they are backward. Do you know, in the Arab countries, they even of the slave trade. At that moment, Ahmed Shoukry, who was part of the Egyptian delegation, stood up and said that if the Israeli ambassador were to persist in this line of talk, he was going to insist on permission to talk about the white slave trade. Whereupon, Abba Eban went as white as a sheet, as pale as a ghost, and sat down. So the first time in his life, the great sophist of the 20th century was rendered absolutely speechless, because he knew that if Ahmed Shoukry were given permission to talk about the white slave trade, then the Jewish role in the white slave trade, which is in fact a Jewish monopoly, would be revealed.
Well, the reason I brought up the connection to the New England Jews, especially Aaron Lopez, who was one of the richest people in North America because of the black slave trade, when they were bringing the blacks in, when they dropped the blacks off for their sale to the plantations, they picked up sugar cane and sugar in the Caribbean nations and brought it to this Jewish-controlled rum industry, where they produced the rum and spirits, which went back and went into Africa to trade for more blacks. And so basically they were already using the drug alcohol in advance of the opium trade. Before opium became a worldwide tradable good, they were already using spirits and alcohol in the same way. It was not any different. They were using it as a tool for political and power control.
As an instrument of demoralization, so that a demoralized population could be politically controlled.
That's right. Exactly.
So, now, what about the dissemination of fire water amongst the Plains Indians? Could that be possibly
right.
The same scenario?
Well, it's exactly right, and not only that, they used the same MO with the poisoning of them with the disease as the British did in advance, and it might be their experience using disease to kill off the Indians that brought the same methods to South Africa when they needed to use it. See, they already knew that biological weapons could be propagated through, smallpox outbreaks or whatever. They have been using disease cultures to kill people off for many centuries. And they're going to do it again, by the way.
Well, they spread syphilis amongst the Polynesians, didn't they?
That's right. And you'll note that the United Fruit Company that was working out of Central America and out of the Caribbean and Hawaii was controlled by Castle
Cook. They controlled the economy of all the banana republics, you know, like Nicaragua and Guatemala. Hmm?
And a lot of Jewish money set those companies up.
Yes.
So we can get back to the war now, James. I want to talk a little bit about the entire shifting of the map, if you will, because we've got about 14 minutes left here. I want to go into the what happened after the war ended, and the peace conference in Versailles came, because we knew Benjamin Friedman talked about almost exclusively the American contingent was from Jewish controlled. I mean, the Jews were. It was Brandeis that sent the people, and Morgenthau, and we had Ben Friedman there, and so many others that were creating the new map in Europe. You want to talk a little bit about
Europe? What about the Balkanization of the Middle East?
Artificial
frontiers? The same families live in Damascus, as live in Beirut, as live in Jerusalem, as live in Amman.
That's right.
Syria is at this moment divided among 7 or 8 countries. When I tell that to people, they won't believe me. So I'll list them to you. There is the one state called Syria, with its capital at Damascus. There's the Vilayet of Antakya and Iskandarum, which the French gave to Turkey in 1939 as a bribe to make sure she wouldn't enter the Second World War on the German side, as she did in 1914. There is Lebanon, which is the name of a mountain, not a state. If you had said to Emdi in Damascus, down to 1935, I'm going to Lebanon, people would have thought you were visiting some village in a mountain. There was no state called Lebanon. Then there is Jordan, which is the most absurd state perhaps in the history of the world. Then there is the West Bank. Then there is the Gaza Strip. And then finally there is Israel, which some, occupied Palestine, which some people call Israel. So there you have one country which has been partitioned into statelets and thereby rendered impotent, which is what, of course, the Americans are planning with Iraq. They are going to divide Iraq into 3 states. A Shiite one in the south, a Sunni-controlled one in the center, based in Baghdad, and a Kurdish nationalist state in the north.
Well, and you can see that they're working with this supposed champion of Iraqi rights. This Mehdi army is controlled completely by intelligence services, Mossad, and they're doing the bidding, getting rid of the intellectuals, killing off anybody who might oppose them. And once everybody is too much in the dark to ever oppose it, they're going to implement the exact plan you just said.
Well, Mossad at this moment has murder squads roaming Iraq at will and with impunity, eliminating the Iraqi intelligentsia. And any pro-Iranian intellectuals, because they are desperate to prevent the spread of Iranian influence up to the shores of the Mediterranean.
Well, they've got their own people in the Iranian government, though. They've already got their own subversives inside of Iran as well. Because the Iranians are still doing business with Israel in backdoor channels to buy parts, and they're still selling oil to the Jews. And so, you know, when you take a look at the reality of that relationship, a lot of it is bluster and a lot of it is for show. And you know something, the political class of Iran is as corrupt as any country in the world. And when you start finding out that the deals being done behind closed doors stand in the face of what they're reporting in the press.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this stuff, it continues. They need somebody told me from Iran that they needed a boogeyman. They need somebody in Islam to turn the world's hatred against. And the country that's been elected for that is Iran. And so mm-hmm. they're going to use them. They're going to be the boogeyman. Everybody's supposed to fear them. And the fact of the matter is, from behind closed doors, they're playing right along with it, because you can see Ahmadinejad putting his 2 cents in all at the worst times. The guy always puts his 2 cents in right when he shouldn't. And it's to keep this propagation of hatred against Islam. And you know what? I've seen it for a while. I've reported on it. And then you see the Russians saying, oh, we'll help you, Iran, and then right when they're supposed to help, they don't. And then you see Putin's group opening up political offices in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv, and him doing the photo ops constantly with the Shabbat Lubavitch rabbis. I mean, you know, people don't understand the story behind the story, James.
Well, there are strange things that happen. I mean, down to the Treaty of Gulistan, which I think was 1819, Azerbaijan was part of Iran. And it had to be ceded to Russia in that year, according to the terms of the treaty. Now, the Iranians retained southern Azerbaijan, which the communists tried to seize in 1945 in pursuit of their policy going right back to Tsarist times of the need for a water port, because it would bring them that one step nearer the Persian Gulf. However, when the war broke out between Armenia and Azerbaijan, Iran offered to mediate, and the Azerbaijanis, who are in fact Iranians, complained that Iranian mediation was biased on the side of Armenia. on the side of the Christians against their fellow Muslims. But this was under Rafsanjani, and I think he is much less influenced now than before.
Oh, no, but Ahmadinejad comes from the Rafsanjani camp.
Well, that's not what my friends in the Iranian embassy tell me, because they say that every time a regime changes, like Ahmadinejad coming to power a few years ago, then all the embassy staff get changed, and not only that, but the Iranian radio, television, all these things with their offices in the West, and these people who are generally raw and inexperienced have to be retrained.
Well, you know what, I see too many parallels to other conspiracies, and I see the fact that, you know, deals are still being done with Israel, with their sworn enemy, in backdoor deals. They were doing deals back in the 1980s, to sell armaments through Israel into Iran. They've still got Mossad contacts going on between the Iranian leadership and Israel. The Iranians know exactly who's running things in that Middle Eastern region, and it's interests from the Jewish community out of America.
Under the Shah, I mean, the links were extremely close, because it was Mossad and the CIA that trained Savak, and Savak was the most feared secret service in the whole world. I mean, it was every bit as bad as the KGB. Friends of mine were tortured by Savak.
Well, but you have to understand, too, that many of those leaders of the Pahlavi false government are still very powerful people. They just shifted their flag. They just changed the flag in front of their house.
Oh.
Of course, the Pahlavis at the top were taken out, but many of the big money men that were doing deals out of that area, the merchants and the rest coming from the Zionist community, are still very busy there.
Well, this is news to me. I mean, you obviously know things that I don't.
Well, I got to tell you something. There's too many coincidences coming out of that region, and there's too many deals being done and then brokered that say to me either these people are absolutely stupid beyond measure, or they're lying to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to go with my research and my gut instincts when I see people doing things and saying something different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you take people for their actions, not for their words, because the words are easy to manipulate, but the actions are a little more telling, if you will. I want to get back to, and before we go on and end up the show here, we've got a couple of minutes left. James, do you have anything to share with the listeners about what we've talked about tonight? Because we've got just only 6 minutes left, and I want you to have an opportunity to address our large audience here and tell them what you'd like to tell them.
Well, I think you've said it yourself, Darrell, in bringing up the subject of the Balkanization of the Middle East, because the first part of the world to be Balkanized was the Balkan Peninsula itself. Then after 1918, you had the Balkanization, the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire, its reduction to insignificance through the creation of artificial political entities called states, and the same pattern was followed in Central Europe with the creation of artificial states like Czechoslovakia, which is now split up, a civilized divorce, showing retrospectively that there were no they ever mentions that Hitler was right, that Czechoslovakia is not a state or a country at all. Mussolini called it a salami state because the 12 different ethnic ingredients. Or Yugoslavia, the country of the southern Slavs, which is now broken up into about five or six different countries. And indeed Poland, although there is a Polish national identity, Poland as a state was created with the same objective. The way that Zionism always works is through the erosion of national sovereignty. And we can see that that's how it works everywhere.
It's happening now, James, in the United States. There are people saying the next country to get carved up is the United States, and there'll be six or eight different regions in the country that are autonomous from each other, and that the idea of the United States is no longer going to be viable going forward, because they're going to remove the ability of America to govern itself through the destruction of its financial system and its ability to feed itself. They've taken away the farming community. They've taken away the food reserves. They've taken away the military prowess of the country has been gutted. What's going to be left is a shell of a nation broken up into anarchy and parts that are not manageable and governable as a whole. And it was done intentionally, and it's going to balkanize, exactly as you just stated. Exactly.
Well, I didn't know that, but I know from the times I've stayed in America, meeting Texans, that they look on Texas as an independent state, detached from the rest of America. And as for George W. Bush, how we're going to miss him, aren't we? The mangled syntax, the mistakes in agreement, and those quaint folksy expressions of which his speeches are full, which are incomprehensible to anyone born outside the frontiers of Texas, maybe one of the future Balkanized states.
Yeah, but you have to be interested in the fact that George Bush was a New Englander, came out of Maine, and his family was brought down there in the middle of the last century to take over that region. But you also have to know that Texas was one of the main entry points for Zionist Jews back at the turn of the last century. And Houston and the oil industry in that area is run by Murano Jews and by Jewish interests that have always been preeminent and predominant in that region. But America, again, they've destroyed its ability to fix itself at this point. What we can do is try to keep it together through the love of the Constitution. See, the Constitution as a document is probably the greatest document of freedom ever written, and people understand right away when you look at it that it is many people believe it has divine providence in it. The fact is, if we can come together around that Constitution, we have a chance. If we allow regionalizations to happen and infighting, which is what they've been successful at doing throughout history, America as a country will cease to exist, and that is not long in coming, in my view. So, James, we're at the top of the hour here. I want to thank you for this most enlightening conversation. I hope the audience has been as stirred by this information as I have been. You are always an incredible visitor to the French Connection, and I want to thank you.
Well, I like the way you conduct these conversations as a compere, the way you steer the discourse from one subject to another, showing up the interconnectedness of all these things.
Well, I've taken some years at settling myself with these facts, and people can check them. If you have some things to correct me on or James on, I will forward James the information if you've got it, and vice versa, I hope, James. You know, one of the things is we're always in a learning process here. We are not about hatred. We are about freedom and caring and honest people, and we love family values, and we want people to have a great future in this world, not one that's fraught with murder and disease and sickness and power struggles. And it is contingent upon our efforts that these things won't happen, so we all have to come together. So, ladies and gentlemen, until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith, along with my guest James Dickey, Yaakov Zaki, saying goodbye and be well. Bye-bye now.
Assalamu alaikum.